From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the history behind one of the most contested issues in the Middle East, an issue that divides Israelis, the future of the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. We talk with David Newman, chairman of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Also, we meet Gino Yevjevich, the lead singer of the Bosnian-Bulgarian punk rock band Culture Shock. He was a pop star in Sarajevo when the Bosnian War broke out. He was trapped in Sarajevo for 3 years and now lives in Seattle. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the dialect of journalese. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. intelligence officials acknowledged today that the CIA failed to tell other agencies what it knew about two men who took part in the September 11th attacks. Both the men were on the plane that struck the Pentagon. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Intelligence officials say they first learned of the men in December 1999. That's when one of them used a telephone that had been used by other terror suspects. Both men, Nawaf al-Hamzi and Khalid al-Midar, showed up at a meeting of people linked to al-Qaeda in Malaysia in January 2000. U.S. officials acknowledged that at that point the CIA could have asked to put the two men on a watch list, alerting U.S. Immigration and the FBI. CIA officials insist they did not do that because they did not realize the full significance of that Malaysian meeting until many months later. That's when the U.S. discovered that one of the suspects in the bombing of the USS Cole had also attended. Finally, in August 2001, the agency put out an appeal to track down the two men, but by then they were both inside the United States. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
Amid complaints about its handling of intelligence before the September 11th attacks, the FBI is trying to simplify procedures for agents who want to get authorization for searches and secret wiretaps. New rules call for the FBI director to personally review any requests for wiretaps that have been denied by lower-level officials. The new procedure comes after an FBI agent in Minneapolis complained that a supervisor in Washington interfered with her office's investigation of Zakaria Moussaoui, who'd been charged with conspiracy in the September 11th attacks. Microsoft has agreed to stop misrepresenting its financial reports in order to settle charges brought by the Securities and Exchange Commission. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The SEC accused Microsoft of understating its profits at times by setting aside unnecessary reserves of up to $900 million. The software giant admits to no wrongdoing but agreed to a cease and desist order. The SEC is investigating other companies for allegedly inflating their sales and profits, but Berkeley accounting professor Brett Truman says it's not uncommon for companies to understate profits in good times, then draw on their reserves when business turns down.
Investors who are not very savvy with respect to accounting would be very surprised to find out the numerous ways companies, if they wanted to, could manage downward their revenues and their earnings.
The SEC frowns on this so-called cookie jar accounting, saying it gives investors an inaccurate picture of companies' current results. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 215 points or 2.2% to close at 9,709 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ lost 53 points. This is NPR News. Prosecutors in Columbia, Missouri, have charged a former nurse with murder in the deaths of 10 patients at a Veterans Administration hospital. The nurse, Richard Williams, has denied any wrongdoing in the more than 40 deaths of patients under his care at the hospital in 1992. The FBI has labeled 11 of those deaths as highly suspicious and said that another 22 were moderately suspicious. In one case, a judge awarded $450,000 to the widow of a patient whose body had elevated levels of codeine when he died. The judge found that the hospital was negligent for not removing Williams from his duties after suspicions were aroused. Three people have been injured in shootings in Northern Ireland as sectarian violence continued for the fourth night in a row. The trouble in East Belfast comes during the celebration of the Queen's Jubilee. Mary Maguire reports from Belfast.
Up to 1,000 people were involved in hand-to-hand fighting in one of the most divided areas of Belfast. Shots were fired as trouble flared in East Belfast. In the first incident, two men were shot in the back as rival Catholic and Protestant gangs clashed. 2 hours later, a bus driver was wounded when his vehicle came under attack from a gunman. Earlier, Northern Ireland's police chief warned that the region was slipping into an abyss. Colin Cramporn also believes that it is also a matter of time before somebody is killed if the situation is not diffused. Tensions are expected to escalate as the Protestant marching season grows closer. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
Movie executive Lou Wasserman has died. He was 89. Wasserman spent more than 50 years with MCA, the parent company of Universal Studios. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most controversial issues in the Middle East is the future of the Israeli settlements in the territories of the West Bank and Gaza. The Palestinians do not want Israeli settlements in a Palestinian state. My guest David Newman says nothing causes as much heated debate in Israel as the future of the settlements. Newman has written extensively about the settlements and their history. He's the author of a 1991 book about the settlements in the West Bank. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post and the editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics. He's also the chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. I asked Newman to describe the Israeli arguments on each side, starting with the argument that Israel should keep the settlements.
The arguments for keeping the settlements are obviously made by the settlers and the supporters themselves. And I would say there are two types of argument. First of all, there is a sort of a religious ideological argument which the settlers use to justify why they are there in the first place. They argue that the land in 1967 was not conquered or occupied, but it was liberated. It was returned to its rightful owner, that God gave them the land, and that this ancient land of Israel should be occupied by Jews and not by other nations, and therefore they have created settlements as a means of preventing any future territorial withdrawal from these areas. The other argument is the security argument. The security argument says we have to have the West Bank to maintain Israel's wider security, and that we can't afford to give it up to any form of foreign control, be it the Palestinians or other. And the settlers say that they are maintaining that security profile in the West Bank.
For the Israelis who believe that the settlements help Israeli security, how do they think they help it?
Well, I think it's true to say that most Israelis do not feel that the settlements contribute to security. The settlers used to argue that by us living in the West Bank, we prevent security problems taking place in Tel Aviv and Netanya and Jerusalem. And obviously this has not been the case in the past 18 months with all the suicide bombers and so on. And even more so, the settlers who went out to show that they control the area, they control the environment, now find themselves completely controlled and besieged by the environment themselves. Their wives, their children are scared to travel on the roads. They have strong fences around the settlements. And in fact, the army have to put in extra troops to provide their safety. So in fact, many Israelis would argue not only do they not contribute to security, many would argue they're even a security hazard.
How in the minds of people who think it contributes to security, how does it contribute to security?
The people who think it contributes to the security think they're giving a sort of cordon sanitaire to the main Israeli population centres, and that by having settlements in outlying areas, therefore this prevents terrorism or military attacks taking place inside Israel proper.
Now let's get to the argument on the other side. For Israelis who don't think that Israel should stay in the settlements, why do they think that the settlements aren't helping Israeli security?
Again, there are a number of reasons here. First of all, there are those who are ideologically opposed to any form of settlement in land which they believe is occupied and which does not belong to Israel by any sort of sovereign or international recognition. They also do not believe that these settlements contribute to security because isolated settlements do not prevent the incursion of suicide bombers or even of armies. And we've seen that recently with the bombings in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, Netanya, and all the Israeli metropolitan centers. The notion that single settlements could contribute to security was an old notion. It was probably relevant in the 1920s and 1930s when the earlier kibbutzim were set up in outlying areas. But of course, technology of warfare has changed, and an individual settlement does not really provide any additional security to the state as such.
What is your understanding of what the settlements signify to Palestinians?
Oh, it's very clear that the settlements, more than anything else, signify to the Palestinians the continuation of Israeli control and occupation. In other words, every house that is built or every settlement that is expanded is for the Palestinians some form of proof that they are not going to get their independence because their land, as they perceive it, is being taken away by these Israeli civilian settlements. And so for them, settlements, more than probably any other single thing, it signifies for them that they are not going to get an end to occupation.
What do opinion polls in Israel now say about opinion on the settlements?
I think what you find is that opinion is divided depending on what particular question you ask concerning the settlements. There is, of course, sympathy towards the individuals in the settlements who are injured, who are maimed, who are killed by bombings and shootings, particularly if it's mothers or children. But on the other hand, I think there's a growing, I wouldn't say consensus, but a growing percentage of the Israeli population who say that if and when we get back to the negotiation table and we draw some form of future boundary and there is a contiguous territory on the other side, a Palestinian territory, then we cannot allow the existence of settlements to be the one obstacle to implementing that peace agreement.
Can you give us an overview of the number of settlers on the West Bank and Gaza and the amount of territory that they cover?
Well, if we talk about the West Bank and Gaza Strip without including East Jerusalem, then we're talking roughly about 200,000 settlers. That does not mean 100,000 families, of course, because a vast majority of these settlers are religious families, young families with many children. So it's probably talking about between 30 to 40,000 households as such, because many of them have young families and so on. Many of the population are religiously motivated and very ideologically committed to their cause, and therefore they've come to this area not because of any political opportunism or not simply because of the economic incentives which they have benefited from to build their houses in these outlying areas.
So, and how much territory would you say the settlements cover?
Well, each settlement on its own doesn't cover a large amount of land, but of course settlements have their planning blueprints which allows them to expand on wider areas of land in the future. And in fact, when in the past they've spoken about a settlement freeze, they've usually referred to the construction of new settlements, but not the expansion of existing settlements. In addition to that, the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip are planned and organized along the lines of municipal and regional councils, as happens inside Israel proper. And this allows the government or the planners to control much wider areas of land than those which are occupied by the houses themselves.
I don't understand why. Can you explain that?
Because what happens is the country is divided up into regional municipal councils, and the regional councils include within them land which is not part of the settlements themselves. And therefore the regional councils can in some cases have planning and zoning controls over the land between settlements and not just within the built-up area.
And are there Palestinians living in that land?
Yes, what happens is there's a totally dual landscape in the West Bank, unlike inside Israel proper, where the regional councils cover all of the people in the area or in the jurisdiction area itself. What happens in the West Bank is that there are regional councils for the Israeli settlements and a completely different parallel planning setup or framework for the Palestinian townships and villages. So there's a sort of dual space in which you have two parallel planning regional systems operating in the same space at the same time, and that obviously gives rise to a lot of conflict over zoning and planning.
David Newman is my guest. He's chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel, and he's editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics. He's done a lot of research on writing on the subjects of Israel's boundaries and the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. We're talking about the settlements. Let's look a little bit at the history of the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. The settlements begin after the 1967 war. How do they begin?
Well, they begin on a very limited scale because for the first 10 years after the Six-Day War, there was a Labour government, and that Labour government did not want to settle the whole of the West Bank. They were not influenced by the religious or the historical motivation, which the later settlers were. And they devised a plan called the Alon Plan, which was basically a security settlement plan in which the government said, we're just going to create settlements, the old type like the kibbutz and the moshav, along the Jordan Valley, because at the time the Jordan Valley was seen as providing the future security boundary of the State of Israel. But that same government did not create settlements in the interior areas, in the mountainous areas, where the vast majority of the Palestinian population reside until this day, because they saw this as being some form of a future agreement by which it would be an autonomous area linked to the State of Jordan.
How did Israeli settlers start moving into that interior area?
It basically started after the October 73 Yom Kippur War, when some of the more ideologically or religiously motivated groups decided that it was time to start pushing the government to settle in the heartland of the West Bank, particularly as they saw and continue to see this area as being the religious heartland of the ancient biblical sites. At the time, the government of Israel was opposed to it, but the seeds were laid at that time. And once the first right-wing government of Menachem Begin came to power in 1977, they then got the green light, particularly the Gush Emunim, religious nationalist settler movement, to move ahead and start creating settlements even in the interior areas.
So the religious nationalist settlement movement was a movement of people who believed that God had given the Jews that land and that therefore the Israelis should go and inhabit it.
Yes, they believed that this was part of the biblical divine promises to the people of Israel, to the fathers Abraham and Isaac and so on. And they saw the war of 1967, the Six-Day War, not as a war of defense or control or occupation, but they defined it as a war of liberation in which the land returned to its rightful owners. And once it was returned to its rightful owners, they therefore argued that no government had the right to give this up to any foreign rule in the future.
You say that from 1984 on, there was agreement in Israel's coalition governments to freeze all further settlement activity in the territories, and yet the settlements continued to grow. Let's start with the agreements to freeze settlement activity. What was behind those agreements?
Well, because settlement is one of the most contentious political issues, there are those, as I said before, who believe that you must have settlement in order not to have any form of territorial withdrawal, whereas the left wing in Israel and the Labour parties believe that settlements are a hindrance or an obstacle to future political agreements, then whenever coalition governments were set up, they always had to find some form of compromise or agreement over policy relating to the settlements. Because a right-wing government would have said, let's continue to build them. A left-wing government would have said, let's stop building them and let's not give any more resources to them. So the compromise which was made in 1984 and in a number of subsequent coalition governments was that settlements would be frozen. In some cases, they allowed a very limited number of new settlements to be built. In other coalition agreements, they spoke about a total freeze. But in retrospect, what has happened is that it only meant a freeze on creating new settlements, not on the consolidation and expansion and extension of the existing settlements. And basically, since 1984 until today, the settler population has grown from 30,000 to nearly 200,000, the vast majority of which has taken place within the existing settlements which had been set up in those early 1980s.
How are settlements handled in the Oslo Peace Agreement?
In the Oslo Peace Agreement, again, there was meant to have been a freeze on any further or future settlement activity. And settlement was one of the five issues, together with such other heavy issues as Jerusalem and refugees, which were put off for the five-year interim period to be negotiated and finalized when the final agreement was drawn up. It was very clear that from a Palestinian perspective, they expected settlements to be evacuated as part of the final agreement. From an Israeli perspective, it wasn't clear what their policy would be in this regard.
There was a survey published by Peace Now in March that said 34 new Israeli settlement sites had been built in the West Bank since Sharon was elected. How have new settlements managed to be built, considering that there had been freezes on them?
Well, I think it's a question of defining what exactly is a new settlement. A new settlement does not necessarily mean every hilltop which is occupied by a few tin huts and two or three families who are determined to make a political point, to sort of make a political protest at the idea that settlements will be evacuated in the future. I think it's very important to make the listener understand that settlements today are not sort of a few small huts or shacks on an outlying hill, but in fact are communities, townships, with houses and roads and infrastructure and services and schools and commercial centres and industrial centres. In that respect, new settlements have not been built. But in the sense of political demonstrations of putting up a few huts on a hill, this has happened whether the government supports it or doesn't.
My guest is David Newman, chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel and editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Newman. He's the chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel, and he's editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics. He's written extensively on the settlements, and we're talking about the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. What has been the role of Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in settlement building? He's a former minister of housing in Israel.
Ariel Sharon in the past was probably one of the ministers most responsible for creating the infrastructure of the settlement in the West Bank. Particularly when he was housing minister, he was very positive towards the settler movement, and they saw him as an ally in their objective of creating as many settlements as possible to control as much territory and land as possible to prevent future withdrawal. So in that sense, Sharon would have a problem in evacuating or making an agreement which would necessitate the evacuation of settlements. And in fact, he continually repeats that any agreement that he makes will not necessarily include the evacuation, certainly not of all the settlements, and he probably would prefer not to evacuate any settlements. On the other hand, Ariel Sharon was also defense minister in the early 1980s when he actually commanded the evacuation of the Israeli settlements in northern Sinai, which was part of the implementation of the Israel-Egypt peace agreement at Camp David. So I think there's an ambivalent attitude here. I think Sharon is a pragmatist in all areas of policy, and should a political agreement be reached under his leadership in the future, which would necessitate the evacuation of some of the settlements, I have little doubt that he would find the means of doing so.
How did the evacuation of the Israeli settlements in the Sinai work, and is that something that Israel could possibly use as a model if they did evacuate settlements in the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, I think the experience of evacuating settlements in northern Sinai is the trauma that Israeli society and Israeli governments have about the scenario of evacuating settlements in the West Bank. It was a fairly violent process. There were demonstrations. Settlers refused to be evacuated. They even fought physically with the soldiers who had been sent to evacuate them. Although at a certain point, the settler movement decided, that's it, that's enough. If we go any further, we're going to end up with fatalities, and it could even end up with a civil war. And I think many Israelis, including the left-wing governments, are very afraid that if and when settlement evacuation takes place in the West Bank, such violence and such fatalities will be of a degree far worse to that which existed in Sinai in the early 1980s.
Are there many people, are there many Israelis moving into the territories now, or now that the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians has increased so much, is movement into the territories virtually stopped? Is maybe movement headed in the opposite direction of people in the settlements wanting to get out?
Interestingly enough, there's always movement into the settlements. Obviously, it doesn't take place at the same pace or rate that it was happening 10 years or even 15 years ago because of the security situation. But there are always a core of young, ideological, religious settlers who are making their first homes and who are prepared to go and live in the settlements. Most of the expansion of the settlements, though, are second and third generation settlers. Remember that the first settlers came at the end of the 1960s, so they already have children and even grandchildren who have been born in the settlements, who have grown up in the settlements, and are now making their homes as a second and third generation in the settlements themselves. There is a limited movement of people out of the settlements into Israel. They tend to take place from the less ideological core of the settlement movement, but there is a limited movement of people who are becoming worried and threatened by the security situation. Of course, the settler movement tries to downplay this. They prefer it not to become a public issue because they don't want this to turn into a mass movement of people back into Israel.
If, as Israel does pull out of the settlements, are there possible scenarios that have been proposed for evacuating the settlers and relocating them?
Well, obviously there are scenarios, because it is very unlikely that settlers of their own will would agree to remain in an area under Palestinian control or Palestinian sovereignty, and we would assume that the Palestinian state would not want them there anyway, and we have to be very realistic about that point. So there are conceptions concerning how the settlers should be relocated. And based on the Sinai experience, we would assume that many of the settlers will simply return to the metropolitan center of Israel, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. But there are plans to try and build settlements in other regions, particularly in the southern Negev region of the Israel, which until today constitutes 60% of the country's land surface and only has about 10% of the country's population. There are still wide areas of undeveloped land there in which the settlers, if they had the same ideological commitment after evacuation, could in fact contribute to the development and the flourishing of the one area in Israel which remains relatively undeveloped today.
And it's undeveloped because it's desert.
It's undeveloped because it's desert. It's undeveloped because it is perceived as being relatively peripheral, although someone listening to that in the United States would say, what is a periphery in a country where you can get anywhere within 1 or 2 hours from the center of the country? It's not such a major problem to develop a semi-arid area today. You can bring piping, you can bring water, you can bring air conditioning. The major problem is to create the necessary employment infrastructure, which will enable people not only to build their houses there, but also to find employment in the region.
David Newman chairs the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel and writes a column for the Jerusalem Post. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips, available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about the Jewish settlements with David Newman. Also, we meet Gino Yevjevich, the lead singer of the Bosnian-Bulgarian punk rock band Culture Shock. He was trapped in Sarajevo during the siege. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the dialect of Journalese. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Newman, who has written extensively about the history of the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. He chairs the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. He says nothing causes as much heated debate in Israel as the future of the settlements. Now, the issue of the settlements is very controversial, very important issue in Israel. Give us a sense of how it's dividing people and perhaps even dividing families.
Well, I think the best answer would be to say it divides my own family. I myself have a left-of-center political position. I believe that settlements should be evacuated, and I have a sister who's a West Bank settler. And we choose not to talk politics when we meet because otherwise it can become extremely sensitive and the tones can be raised. Clearly, it's a very divisive issue because there are those who see settlements as being the only means of preventing future territorial withdrawal, and there are those who see settlements as being the obstacle in the way of implementing any future peace agreement. And there are even those who say that had it not been for the settlements, then the Oslo map would have been a much better map, a more compact map, and we would not have met many of the problems that we have experienced over the past 7 or 8 years.
Do you think your family is pretty typical, that there's a lot of families that are divided like that?
I don't think it's typical of the whole of the Israeli population, but there are many Israeli families, larger families, in which political positions over the Israel-Palestine conflict are divided. You have right-wing and left-wing in single families, and there are a large number of divisions. I wouldn't say it's typical of the whole of the Israeli population, though.
So what direction do you think Israel is heading in right now in terms of the settlements?
I think that anyone who believes that there is going to be a return to political negotiations and some form of political agreement in which there will be a Palestinian state and a clearly defined boundary has to accept that on the other side of that boundary there cannot be settlements. Their settlements will have to be evacuated. Obviously, the boundary, if it is to be redrawn, may include some of the settlements inside Israel, in return for which Israel may exchange territory by the Gaza Strip or by the Green Line as compensation. But whatever the territory of the Palestinian state is determined to be, it is very clear that settlements there will have to be evacuated. And I think it is not just the left wing who see this. It is a very realistic position. It's not an ideological position. And I think increasingly people in the center and people even the moderate right realize that if there is to be a boundary in the future, this will be the implications for the future of settlements.
How have the suicide bombings affected your day-to-day life in Israel? Are you living differently? Are you taking different precautions than you did before? Are there places that you won't go that you used to frequent?
I think to a certain extent the suicide bombs have affected the daily life of many, many Israelis. In my own case, maybe that's less so because I tend to be rather blasé and some people would say even rather irresponsible in the way I think about these things. But just the other day, I caught myself thinking that my two eldest children who study in Jerusalem, they come home every weekend or every second weekend. And then on the Sunday morning, I take them to the bus station, put them on the bus to Jerusalem. And even I have started to get into the mindset which says, oh, I just hope they're not in the wrong place at the wrong time. They're not on the bus or in the bus station or the cafeteria that some crazy suicide bomber is going to come in and bomb today. So I think it has changed the mindset of the Israeli population. There are places which aren't frequented. Every time there is a bombing in a cafe or a nightclub or a disco, so for the first week or 2 weeks afterwards, you find that these places are empty, and it takes time for people to start coming back again.
Do you feel like it's changed your feelings about Palestinians in general?
I think it's clearly changed the minds of many Israelis about their attitude towards the rights of Palestinians. You know, there are two arguments as to why the occupation should end. One argument is because some people say the Palestinians deserve a state. They're 3 million people. And just as the Israelis, we have our flag and our emblem and our anthem and we're proud of our state, so the Palestinians should also have their self-determination and their state. That is an argument which is very hard to sell today because most people have become even more hardline towards the Palestinians because of the terrorism and the suicide bombers. There is another argument, of course, which says that we need to get rid of the occupation because it's good for us, Israel, to get out of the territories and not to have to educate a whole generation, a third and a fourth and a fifth generation of young people in being soldiers of control and soldiers of occupation. And I think it's the second argument which is stronger today, whereas in the past maybe the first argument would have been stronger, but there are a decreasing amount of Israelis today who are sympathetic towards the Palestinian political claims because of the terrorism which is taking place.
Well, David Newman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
David Newman chairs the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. Coming up, a pop star turned punk rocker from Sarajevo. This is Fresh Air. My guest Gino Yevjevic was a teen pop star in Bosnia. Before the siege of Sarajevo, he lived in the city on the opposite side of the river from his mother. He was visiting her for lunch when the siege began and was unable to return home for the duration of the war. When the war ended, he emigrated to the U.S. He now lives in Seattle, where he's the lead singer of the band Culture Shock. The band is made up of two Bosnian emigres, two Bulgarians who defected in the communist era, a Japanese musician, and an American horn section. Culture Shock's music is inspired by gypsy music and other traditional Balkan musics, as well as punk rock. Here's a track that combines both from the new Culture Shock CD. Hey, when Gino Yevjevic was trapped in Sarajevo during the siege, he and several other musicians put together an absurd version of the musical Hair, which they performed for 3 years.
We took over a little theater which was in the middle of Sarajevo. It was a weird situation. It's not just me. It's like everybody else was trapped too. So all of a sudden you have all the recording artists, but, you know, very, very good selling recording artists trapped in one town, because Sarajevo was from before a cultural metropolis of former Yugoslavia. So all the best selling and all maybe the best rock and roll that was in former Yugoslavia was in Sarajevo. So no wonder people, you know, we had so many musicians in the same position like I was. We took over the theater and we put up our version of musical Hair, which was kind of turned upside down.
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
Well, I can't imagine. Hair seems so incongruous. Singing
That's
about
exactly.
The age of Aquarius in Bosnia, you know, when Sarajevo is under siege, does not compute. I mean, so what was your version of Hair?
Yeah, that's the beginning of irony era and cynicism era in my life. From then on, everything is irony and everything is double meaning and everything is cynicism. I rather like to make fun of the things that I like that I don't like. And I loved Hair all the all the way. Long time ago, you know, I wanted to be a hippie. I was too young to be a hippie, though. I was a hippie wannabe when I was like 7. I saw them on TV and I really wanted to be part of them. And then later on, of course, I was part of the punk generation, but Hair, at the time war started, we watched Hair once, me and a couple of my friends, and we laughed so hard, like saying, what do you mean peace on earth? Like, like bombing all around you. Like, what do you mean peace on earth? So what we did, we made a cover version of Killing Me Softly. You know, yeah, we did Hair. We kind of, that's the only way you can go through that stuff. I mean, if you're trapped, if you can die every next 5 minutes, the only way you can do it is to make fun of it, because, you know, that's how you're going to survive. That's how we realize. Actually, we didn't do it consciously. And people were thanking us later on, because Hair was played for 3 years, almost every day. Every day it was sold out. So, you know, and people were thanking us for keeping the spirit of Sarajevo, keeping people insane and stuff. And we did this selfishly just to keep ourselves alive, you know, because if you don't do that, what are you going to do? You're going to, like, just go on the street and say, shoot me, it's done, you know. So that's what we did for 3 years. We kind of occupied a little theater and run the show with all the problems that you can have running the show during the war, having members killed, having, going every single day was a battle, actually, to go from your home where you lived to the theater and back, because you never know. The show was literally more important than our lives, I would say so, because, you know, it's just... Therefore, I get my philosophy, and the culture shock philosophy is like to play every single song like it's the last song in your life, because you never know what's like the last song of your life going to be.
Did you have electricity for the lights in the theater?
No, we didn't. No, we didn't. It's kind of triple suicide. We had electricity, and then all of a sudden, in the middle of the gig, electricity would go down, and it would we would turn acoustic, and then we would steal the electricity from United Nations.
How do you do that?
At least they were good for something, huh? Well, we just, you know, they have their generators; they're better than everybody else. And what we had friends who were good in stealing the electricity from their generators. So from the offices that they were having, we were doing that and running the show. And like for a couple of months, they wouldn't realize that. And then they would cut it off and we would steal it from another side. So it's like, it was fun. So I have to say, sometimes I had the fun of my life there in the war.
So did you have your instruments during the war, and were you able to hold on to them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a musical basically done by the superstars, by the best-selling rock artists who were never on the theater stage. That wasn't like a Broadway musical done by Broadway performer. It was the rock band on the stage. It wasn't a pop Hair. It was a rock Hair. Mm-hmm. It was very dark. Our arrangements were very dark, and our singing wasn't as happy as the hippie Hair also. It definitely wasn't done originally. We rearranged everything and we rewrote the text. It was pretty much the bone of the story, and the initial melodies of the songs were there. Everything else we did pretty much originally.
Now, one of the things that kept people coming to Hair was that there was a scene where the actors are naked. Was that part of your version of Hair?
No, it was cold. Come on. Scary.
Too cold for that.
It was cold. No, come on. I mean, being naked in my country is not as taboo as being naked over here. Uh-huh. I mean, when I came over here, I was here when I was 15, and I really didn't realize that Christian rays on American medias. Right now, I'm like being naked in my country was just a normal thing. I guess I had a couple of musical videos where I have naked people on it. Once I was one of them. But, you know, so that's not a taboo. We didn't do it because it was cold. And it kind of made no sense in a way in the middle of the war. I mean, if you're naked and all of a sudden bombing starts, where are you going to go naked?
So you had this attitude of, you know, make everything ironic, because if you don't have a sense of humor, you're doomed. And it sounds like you got by just fine, but I'm wondering if you had friends who couldn't get to that point of irony, or couldn't get to that point of being like a fatalist, and were kind of troubled and worried and anguished with every move that they make, wondering, if should I turn left or turn right? Is the bullet heading up or is it heading down? Will I get hit or will I avoid it? Because that can either paralyze you or leave you just in this absolutely pained state of constant neurosis.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, in our troop, we had people who were scared to death. And it's not just, I mean, we were friends. We were brothers and sisters, and we really cared about each other. So we kind of, in a way, tried to spare that people of, like, going buy the cigarettes for us, or, you know, get us a booze from the illegal market run by United Nations. Kind of good-willingly making fun of it. You know, I really don't, when we right now sit and remember those days, even those people who were scared of every single move, because scare is something that you cannot control. I thought that, you know, sometimes I was scared to death. Maybe that's my defense. Maybe I was scared enough that you know, kind of convinced myself that I wasn't scared. I know what it is to be scared.
What are some of the differences between playing with a band in Seattle, where you live now, and playing in Sarajevo before the war?
We cannot compare really these two lives, because I was lucky. I was 16 and I was lucky to succeed, and there was a big record label behind my back. They were pretty much telling me what to do. We're playing clubs right now. People are very close to you. You can see what they think. You can see how they look at you. This is a completely new experience, and I don't have television backing me up anymore. I don't have radio backing me up anymore. Like before, you know, you release the record, you have television backing you up, you have radio backing you up, you go, you sell out the arena and you take the money. That was like, that's pretty much a simple way of doing it. Right here is just play, and people come and see you, and more you play, the better you are, more people come and see you, and it's kind of more natural right now in this moment.
Now, is the Balkan traditional music that you've kind of incorporated into your band now, is that, like the gypsy music, is that part of your tradition, or is that just a tradition of the area that you heard a lot?
No, it's part of our tradition also. It's part of our tradition. Gypsies came from India, and they ended on Balkan Peninsula, mostly being in Bosnia, Serbia, and Bulgaria, in Macedonia also, mm-hmm. Actually mostly in Macedonia. When we were growing up, that was the music that wasn't cheesy, and it was folk, and we loved it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like bluegrass over here. You know, you love it because it's pure, and it's full of soul and energy, and it's something that you close your eyes and sing. Gypsies are all around us, and I mean, you can pretty much see people from Balkan Peninsula. They're dark hair with a dark tan. And we're supposed to be Slavs, red hair, tall, and like with freckles, like Russians. We mixed a lot with Arabs, with Turks. Turks were 600 years there. And also when Gypsies came from India, we mixed with them too. So there are all cultures which are giving this particular musical stamp that I'm using.
Did you do folk dancing when you were a kid?
Never in my entire life. We don't have folk dancing over there.
No, you see, American kids grew up, at least in my age, they grew up with like Balkan folk dancing. You know,
yes.
It's very popular here now still. So,
yeah, I have to tell you the story about that. We really like folk dancers here in Seattle, and they come to our shows. And we were invited to Balkanalia Festival in Portland, so we went over there. And being a natives ourselves, you know, they thought that we are natives. So when we started playing, half of the room just got out because, you know, we weren't what they were expecting. And then I had the political speech later on saying, hello, people, let me explain you something. When your grandfathers and grandmothers left, and when the shepherd was playing the flute on the hill, some people still remained in the homeland. You know, they're still there. The people still live there. And believe it or not, we have refrigerators and running water and the computers right now. So electric guitars also. Like, life goes on. You know, it's not... But, yeah, folk dance community is totally American stuff. It goes along, totally. And you know, if there wasn't for folk dancing, we wouldn't have a fundament of our audience base at the beginning at all.
Well, Gino Yevgevich, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Gino Yevgevich is now lead singer of the Seattle-based band Culture Shock. They have a new CD. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on Journalese. This is Fresh Air. New flap roils lawmakers as Gov moles probe. That's Journalese, a dialect of English that hasn't changed much in 150 years. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg explains why newspapers can't resist the language of melodrama.
A journalist I know asked me why she kept seeing the verb roil in the newspaper. What's going on with this, she said. Of course, as soon as she pointed it out, I started noticing it all over the place. In the New York Times the other day, I read about the factors that were roiling the British rail system and the roiling political context of the game of soccer. And the same day's San Francisco Chronicle had a story about anti-government protests that were roiling the eastern region of Algeria and a business page reference to the roiling electricity market, not to mention a headline describing Eminem as the roiling rapper. There's nothing new about roil. It's been around since Shakespeare's time as a slightly recondite synonym for churn up or perturb. But when I did a search in a collection of major newspapers, it turned out the verb is more than 9 times as frequent now as it was 20 years ago, even when you correct for the changing size of the database. In fact, it's up 30% in just the last year. That's a remarkable pop, all the more since there's no external reason for it. I mean, it isn't as if the world is 9 times more turbulent than it was in 1982. But then royal was tailor-made for recycling as a newspaper vogue word. A bit recherché and poetic, but not so obscure that readers can't pick up a general sense of disruption. It's a favorite of headline writers, not surprising, given that it has only 4 letters, 2 of them skinny ones. Migrant pickers, royal watermelon capital, anger and isolation, royal Israeli Arabs, Greenspan remarks, royal markets. Actually, the stock markets alone account for about 15% of all the royalese in the press. Of course, you don't hear royal a lot in ordinary conversation. It isn't really a word of American English at all. It belongs to the patois of that exotic alter America that we read about in the newspapers, a world populated by strongmen, fugitive financiers, and troubled teens, where ire is always being fueled until violence flares, spawning hatred and stirring fears until hopes are dashed. The Associated Press's Jack Capon once imagined how it would sound if ordinary people actually used journalese in their conversations over the backyard fence. Joel, my concern has been escalating for weeks. What's triggering our area youths who keep sparking confrontations? Well, Bill, they certainly shattered the stillness of this affluent neighborhood with their drug-related pre-dawn rampage. This is a venerable dialect. It's been around ever since the mass circulation penny newspapers first appeared around 150 years ago. The garish, sensational dailies that Dickens satirized in Martin Chuzzlewit under names like The Sewer, The Stabber, and the New York Rowdy Journal. Granted, the language of the press has gotten more sedate in recent times, now that most of the tabloids have folded and reporters drink Chardonnay and Cosmopolitans. And yet, modern newspaper diction still evokes the language of the theatrical melodramas that became popular around the same time as the penny press. It's a tone which disappeared from serious fiction around the 1920s, and which you don't even hear much in hard-boiled detective stories nowadays. In fact, the only place other than newspapers where you routinely run into verbs like royal is in gothic romances and especially pornography, where synonyms for churn are always in high demand. Editors are always deploring the excesses of journalese, but for every embellishment they manage to discourage, three new ones spring up in its place. Along with the spectacular growth of royal, for example, the last 20 years have seen sevenfold increases in the use of ratchet and slated. As tensions ratchet up, new peace talks are slated for next month. Reporters tell you that they choose words like royal and ratchet because they were taught in journalism classes that they should try to use action words. Saying that the mayor's decision roiled voters feels more vivid than merely saying that the decision troubled them. It makes it sound as if something's actually taken place since the last edition went to press. The facts may be the same one way or the other, but then journalists know that what sells papers isn't facts but stories. The more dramatic and sanguinary, the better. As a newspaper maxim has it, if it bleeds, it leads. You can't affect what happened at the city council meeting last night, but you can at least describe it in the same language you'd use to summarize the plot of an Indiana Jones movie. Embattled mayor rips foes as deadline looms. That headline could appear as easily in the New York Times as in the New York Rowdy Journal. In fact, it's just the way the press makes the world sound newsworthy. Melodrama and news. The two were born at the same moment, and they've been talking in the same voice ever since.
Jeff Nunberg is a researcher at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Happiest Baby on the Block, The New Way to Calm Crying and Help Your Baby Sleep Longer by Harvey Karp, M.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stan Lee. He co-created Spider-Man 40 years ago for Marvel Comics. Now he's the executive producer of the new Spider-Man movie. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for Fresh Air.